Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan and today I am thrilled to be sharing an interview that I did with author Glede Brown-Kabongo. Glede Brown-Kabongo writes gripping, unputdownable psychological thrillers, unflinching tales of deception, secrecy, danger, and family. She's the Eric Hoffer Next Generation Indie and Ippy Award-winning author of the Fearless series, Our Wicked Lies, Swan Deception, and Conspiracy of Silence. Her novel Winds of Fear was voted one of 24 books to read during the coronavirus by Rhode Island Monthly Magazine. Glede holds a master's degree in communications and has spoken at multiple industry events, including the Boston Book Festival. She's a member of Sisters in Crime, Crime Writers of Color, and the Association of Rhode Island Authors. She's also an instructor with the New Hampshire Writers Project, where she leads workshops and webinars on fiction writing and publishing. She lives outside Boston with her husband and two sons. I recently sat down virtually with Glede to talk about her latest novel, Our Wicked Lies. Please enjoy. Hi, how are you?
I am fine, thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing with the pandemic?
I think like everybody, I am just ready for normal, whatever that is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kids went back to school 4 days a week, and I was happy about that. I felt terrible for being happy about it, but I was. Of course, you know, safety first, but, they needed to go back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would not have done as well in the pandemic if my toddler was not in school a few days a week. I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. No, I think everybody's just about done. We've had it. We're so finished with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have a new book out. How was writing and publishing during a pandemic? How was that different from previous years?
Well, that was really interesting and quite an interesting journey for me as an author as well. Typically, I spend a lot of time at Panera Bread. There is one in my hometown, and so I spend a lot of time there writing. And I couldn't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, well, what am I going to do? You know, that's when my muse shows up, you know, and even my husband, he didn't understand that. He's like, I don't get it. It's busy. It's crowded. There are a lot of people talking and I just couldn't explain it. I'm like, I don't know what it is, but when I go there, it works. And so I said, you know what, I have to write this book. And so for the first time, I wrote a book from start to finish from home.
Wow.
And so yeah, I was like, wow. So the whole Panera thing was a myth. So now, I don't know what's going to happen once everything opens up 100%. It's like, am I going to be looking at Panera with, you know, strange eyes now? It's like, am I going to go back to that routine? It remains to be seen. I don't know.
Oh, that's so interesting. I totally get that though, because whenever I'm doing writing, I have to have background noise and not mm-hmm. like music or anything, but I will literally, there are programs online where you can have like coffee shop chatter in the background.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So that I find like I have to have this interesting combination of like cafe chatter and like maybe a thunderstorm and like possibly someone typing on a keyboard and like that.
Oh my gosh.
Combination will just like get me in the right headspace to just write hours.
I think everybody does it differently. And yeah. I will be checking out the coffee chatter. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, it's very cool. I forget. I discovered it during National Novel Writing Month 1 year. And I was like, mm-hmm. This is a game changer.
It sounds like it. It definitely sounds like it. So I'll be checking that out for sure.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your new book.
Yeah, so I write psychological thrillers. Domestic thrillers are a subgenre of psychological thrillers. So this one, Our Wicked Lies, definitely falls into the domestic thriller domain, if you will. And it's about a wealthy suburban couple. And of course, in domestic thrillers, everything seems to be perfect. They seem to have the perfect marriage until things start to unravel. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of dark secrets and shocking betrayals. There's a shocking and sinister death. And so it's in a way sort of a study of the unraveling of a marriage mm-hmm. and everything that goes along with that, the deceit, the betrayals, the basically the shattering of a family, if you will. And so the book is a combination of all of those things. And thematically speaking, I would say it's about, you know, this woman who, you know, just thinks of herself as an ordinary homemaker. It's about her finding her voice. It's about her finally standing up and saying, you know what, I'm more than this. And so that's what the story's about. It's, I would say, comparable to The Wife Between Us, The Husband's Secret, by Alia Moriarty. Actually, a few reviewers compared it to those authors. So I said, thank you. I'm very flattered.
That's awesome. I love that. What kind of draws you to that thriller genre, the psychological or the domestic thriller?
I think it was just always part of me. I grew up in the Caribbean. I was born there until I was 13 and immigrated to the United States. But growing up, I was an avid reader and I was always drawn to mysteries and suspense. So most of the books that I ended up reading were Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys. There was a British author called Enid Blyton, and I would just gobble up her books. And the funny thing about it, life comes full circle, right? So Mark Dawson, who is a British author and a rock star in the author community, actually has a series that's an ode to Enid Blyton, Famous Five, which I read growing up. So I think those books still resonate with quite a few people who read them growing up.
Oh, that's so cool.
I thought it was cool when I saw that. I'm like, good for you. That's awesome.
That's really fun. I, you know, it's funny. I also was totally, I was all about like Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and things like that as a kid. And I, to this day, read thrillers and there's something
you
there.
You can't get away from it.
You can't, you can't. Once they have your hooks, their hooks in you, they just never let go.
Well, the funny thing is my mom is obsessed with them. That's how, I think that's how I got started. And there is a puzzle that has every single Nancy Drew cover. That's the puzzle, the old ones. And I'm like, I have to get one of those. Of course it's sold out. So
sure,
keeping an eye on that.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I know I was, you know, excited to see that they were re-releasing Nancy Drew for a younger generation, but I also just so adore the originals and the original covers that I'm like, I'm going to have both in my house.
Exactly.
It's like, I don't mind updating them, but also I need the originals too.
Of course. Hardback. Of course.
Yeah, of course.
The original in hardback. Yes.
Yes. That bright, bright yellow.
Yellow. Yes. Carolyn Keene. On every one of them.
Oh, they look so good on a shelf.
They do. They do.
Do you still read mostly thrillers, or do you read a wider variety of books now?
I read a wider variety of books. Of course, thrillers is one of my favorite genres. I read romance. I read nonfiction. I'm pretty eclectic, I would say, in my reading taste. Sometimes I go through phases. Sometimes I go through my, you know, thriller phase. Other times, you know, it's a lot of nonfiction. So sometimes it depends on what I'm in the mood for. And I try not to read when I'm writing, and I end up doing it anyway. And my husband's like, don't you have a project? Don't you have your own book? You're supposed to be writing. What are you doing? And I'm like, you know, it's addictive. Like, you know, once you're an author, once you love books, you just, you can't escape it.
Totally. Yeah. I would not be able to stop reading.
No, no.
It's
never enough.
No.
I must have, like, I don't know how many books I have in my Kindle and my bookshelf, and I just keep getting more and more and more. It's an addiction.
Absolutely. 100%. As a bookseller, I confirm it is an addiction. It's a miracle I take a paycheck home ever. I literally stopped into the bookstore today to do this interview and bought 4 books. Like, I don't.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, stay away from bookstores for a little bit. Nah,
it's
not
dangerous.
Really.
No,
we need our bookstores.
We need them. Do you have any recommendations? Have you read anything good recently?
Gosh, what have I read recently? After a while, it's like so many that it kind of gets blurred. But
they totally blur. I have to keep a written record, otherwise, I'm useless.
Right. I was recently teaching a webinar with New Hampshire Writers Project, and part of it was just kind of talking about the thriller genre and different books in it and things of that nature. And I had The Silent Patient up there, because the twist at the end of that book was mind-blowing. It was fantastic and, you know, really well done. So I absolutely love that one. And I'm looking for a good romance books now, because I love the genre as well. There's Anna E. Ross is a New York Times bestselling author of romance. She writes contemporary romance, and I love her books. And you know, so besides her, I'm looking for you know, a new romance author to add to my favorites list. So if you have any recommendations, let me know.
I will send you, we have a shoppable list on the Gibson's Bookstore website. I will send you the link there. We are,
sounds awesome.
Several of our booksellers have recently discovered that we all love romance. And we've all been reading them simultaneously, and we're all really, really excited. My favorite one that I just finished is called Honey Girl by Morgan Rogers. It is beautiful. It's about a girl who, she has just, a woman, she has just gotten her PhD in astronomy, and she goes to Las Vegas to celebrate, and she gets married.
And that's a setup for all kinds of
that, trouble. Right? And you would think that would be like, oh gosh, it's going to be this quirky, but actually she ends up sort of falling in love with this woman who she married, Yuki Yamamoto. And it is a story, it's a coming of age story. It's a story of loneliness and finding yourself, and also just like the most beautiful romance you've ever read. It is gorgeous. So highly recommend Honey Girl by Morgan Rogers. That's a beautiful one.
All right. No, I like when a romance novel has, you know, a different element to it.
So it definitely took turns I wasn't expecting, and I loved it for that.
Cool.
So you mentioned the New Hampshire Writers Project, which is how we were connected. So I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that organization and how you got involved with it.
So the New Hampshire Writers Project, it's an organization that promotes, you know, the writing, obviously, literature among New Hampshire writers. And so the organization is about empowering writers in the Granite State, about putting together programs that will, you know, help achieve that. And so what I do is I teach webinars. I spoke at the 603 annual conference last fall. Right now I'm involved in a writing lab. And so the way the writing lab is set up, there's, you know, various genres. So, you know, if you live in the Granite State, and I shouldn't even just say just New Hampshire, because we've had people from Australia and out of state attend webinars.
Cool.
So I guess it sort of has a global reach if you really think about it that way.
Yeah.
But the idea was to set up these writing labs in different genres. So, you know, if you're an aspiring writer in, you know, fantasy or thriller writing, you know, YA, whatever the case may be, then you can come to the writing lab. You submit the first 10 pages of your manuscript about a week or so in advance, and I would look it over and write up a critique, and then we dive into it during the writing lab. And so the idea behind the writing lab is that if you have a work in progress, the advice and the guidance that you get when you attend the writing lab, you can go back and implement it right away into your manuscript and keep going. And so the idea is to provide that practical writing coaching guidance to aspiring writers.
That's wonderful. That must be so helpful. What a great resource for writers.
Yeah, it's been a great resource based on emails that I get. So I'm happy that I get to do that.
That's awesome. How long have you been an instructor with the New Hampshire Writers Project?
I would say it's about a little over a year.
Nice.
If my math is correct. Yeah.
Very nice. Do you have any, what's your go-to advice for an aspiring writer?
Sure. I would say study the craft. And you're never too good or never too successful to do that. There's always something to be learned. You have to be a voracious reader. You cannot be an author with any level of success without loving books and just loving to read, read, read. And so those are the two pieces of advice that's, you know, the go-to advice that I would give aspiring writers. Study the craft in any way, shape, or form that you can. There's always something to be learned. I published my first novel in 2012, and I still just absorb information like a sponge. Mm-hmm. You know, publishing, like anything else, multiple twists and turns and changes and, you know, a lot going on. And so it's a lot to keep up with. Mm-hmm. But I think at the end of the day is to always make sure that you are learning the craft, you are getting better. And I try to do that with, you know, every book. I try to get better and better, even if it's just one element to work on. So that's those are two pieces of advice that I give to aspiring writers. Always read, read a lot. And study the craft, whether it's taking a workshop or a webinar, going to a conference, you know, just reading a book on craft. Some people are in writing groups. There's just so many ways that you can do that. And, you know, it's up to the person to decide how they want to do that. But I think it's a must.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah, you can't really be a writer if you're not a reader, I think.
I mean, I guess you can. I know it's possible.
But
it's not possible.
The best writers are voracious readers, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What sort of, one of the things that when I talk to folks who are aspiring writers or to authors, the idea of writer's block always comes up. What are your tips when you hit writer's block or brain fog, quarantine brain fog, or whatever it may be? How do you get through that?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what I used to do, and then I'll tell you a little trick that I discovered that I'm still working on implementing. Mm-hmm. So some people say writer's block is not real. For me personally, it is real. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've seen the little funny meme that says writer's block when your imaginary friends refuse to speak to you. and I'm like, yeah, that's a really, you know, succinct way to describe it. And I think for everybody, writer's block is different. For me, what it means is that there's something about a particular scene that I'm just, you know, not able to either wrap my brain around, or it's not manifesting itself in the way that I'm thinking about it on the page, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's something about a particular scene that's preventing me from expressing it in the way that I would like to. And so what I would do is, if that would bother me, I would just put the manuscript down. I mean, I sometimes wouldn't touch the manuscript for weeks. Mm. Or even months, because that particular thing was bothering me and I just felt paralyzed, but I couldn't move on until I had solved that problem. And so, of course, you know, imagine how much time I lose, right? Mm-hmm. Doing that. And so, you know, I said, you know what? I can't continue to do this. I have to find a way to keep going. And so in screenwriting, right, which is another mm-hmm. art form completely, you know, its own rules from writing a novel. Basically what you can do is, you know, think about movies are not shot in sequence necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so screenwriters, a lot of times they will, you know, write the scenes, right? Each scene is a vignette. It must stand on its own. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of, you know, assemble everything together. Same principle with a movie, right? Shoot out a sequence, everything comes together on the editing floor, right, to create the film that we see. Well, we can apply the same thing to writer's block, right? So what I've started doing is, you know, kind of thinking like a screenwriter. Okay, let me look at my flashcards. Don't laugh, I actually use flashcards. I know we have Scrivener and all of these different programs, but I literally write everything down in a flashcard, every scene that I think is going to be in the book, mm-hmm. everything that I'm thinking, and then I separate them into piles. And then each pile represents one act, act one, act two, act three. Then I sit down to outline the novel. And as I'm outlining and it comes together, I write a little paragraph snippet, you know, for each scene. Sometimes each scene represents a chapter. Sometimes it doesn't. And so that's how I started getting over my writer's block. I just, you know, shuffle everything. Look at all the different scenes and just, you know, pick one and I keep going.
I love that. That's amazing. And visually, that's a really cool way to kind of shuffle your novel around and be like, okay, here, mm-hmm. here it is. It's funny, in college, my college roommate did something very similar with her final thesis. She had all these note cards where she was like organizing her whole, you know, 40, 50 page paper, whatever it was. And at one point she was in sort of the final stages. And so she was laying it all out and they were all color coded. And it was our entire like living room was all these beautiful neon note cards. And I was like, I'm sure this makes sense to you.
No, it really worked for her.
So yeah, I love that.
I do color code the cards. I go to the dollar store and I get stacks of flashcards, and different colors represent different characters.
Perfect.
And that also helps me to visualize their arc.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah, it works. Yeah.
I should probably do that because I always try writing just like, you know, chronologically beginning to end. And I usually get burnt out about halfway through and give up.
I used to do that. And that's why writer's block was whipping me so badly, because I was a chronological writer where I had to write everything from beginning to end. And if I get stuck, you know, that was a problem. So, you know, I'm like, you know, there has to be a better way. So that's how I solved it.
Oh, I love that. Do you find that certain types of scenes are harder to write? Like, do you put off certain types of scenes when you're shuffling around? Like, you pull out when you're like, maybe later, pick a different one.
Of course. I'm the queen of procrastinating. Since I was a kid, I was like that. And it stayed with me in adulthood. So I know all about the procrastinating. Yeah, there's some scenes that if they're big scenes, right, that involve maybe multiple characters or strong emotions, you know, or something like that, I tend to put those off just because, you know, I need to get into that right headspace. You know, there's a lot that needs to go on in that particular scene. So I tend to put those off. I remember in my novel, Autumn of Fear, I wrote a love scene. And let me tell you, I'd rather pull my hair out. typically, love scenes aren't really part of psychological thrillers. They typically, you know, either behind the door or it's not really, you know, explored. But, I kind of felt that it was necessary for those two characters. And it was painful. Mm. It was so painful because, you know, you're thinking, okay, this is a thriller. Love scenes is not a thing per se. You're thinking about, you don't want it to be cheesy. You don't want it to be ridiculous, and it has to make sense. So in my mind, I knew that it made sense. It was a matter of, okay, how do I execute that on the page? And I don't like that. It's painful. It really is. There's so many other things that I would rather be doing. Other scenes I'd rather write than having to do that. Luckily, like I said, it was just, you know, for that book. It's not, you know, necessarily something that I will repeat constantly throughout my novels. It just makes sense for that particular book. But I think that was one of the toughest scenes that I've ever had to write. And then sometimes there's scenes where, you know, they're really emotional and you're human. And even if you are the one, you know, putting those thoughts and feelings on the page, they affect you too. And so sometimes that happens. Sometimes that can be really difficult to write.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that I feel like authors are always sort of putting themselves into their books. Do you find that that's especially true in emotional scenes?
I think sometimes, because you're right. I think as an author, part of who we are, we always bring that to the stories that we tell. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of times you'll see our experiences, you know, or people we know, or things that have happened, or remembering how certain emotions impacted us. And I would say, yes, if you're going to be writing honestly and authentically, you will at times, depending on the story, draw from real life experiences. And, you know, sometimes you put yourself on the page. It's just that you can't let your reader know that. Your reader has to be fully vested in that character and to make sure that none of who the author is coming through in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you wanted to touch on before we wrap up?
I think we're pretty good. Since you asked some really great questions, I would just say, going back to your question about advice to aspiring writers, self-doubt and fear, you know that is something that absolutely just plagues authors. It doesn't matter if you sold 10 million books or you're just starting out. Every story that you put out there, there is a doubt that constantly plagues you, whether you're good enough, whether the story's good enough. And if, you know, no matter how much praise you get, there's always, you know, someone who won't like it, and that's okay. And I think that's important for aspiring authors to know as well. Not everybody's going to love your books.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, typically they'll say, well, you know, who's the audience for your book? And it's like, everybody. Well, no, it isn't. It can't be for everybody.
Not for everyone.
And so I would just say, you know what? Tell the stories for the people who love your books and the people who totally get you. And that's okay.
Absolutely. And that's where, you know, booksellers really come in handy, because we can be like, aha, I know the audience for your book. I will put your book in their hands.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all I have for you today. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast and chatting with me a bit.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Ryan. I really enjoyed our chat.
Thank you again to Glidde Brown Kabongo and to the New Hampshire Writers Project for connecting us. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks. Bye.